Well, this is lesson three, and today we're going to cover chapter 17 and 18, and the title of this lesson is Micah, Dan, and Idols. And I am going to skip reading the passage, as we've been doing, because we'll read it as we take each of the verses together. Or as we deal with each section. All right, the first thing I want to mention as we get started in this particular section, you may think, wow, how do you go about figuring that we should look at chapter 17 right after we look at chapter 3, verses 1 through 6? And part of the reason why I'm doing this is I'm convinced this is the layout of the chronology. It's a little more closely assigned in terms of what happened next, and I think that can be very helpful in guiding us to the history of Israel at this time. Plus, I think it fits very well with the lessons learned in chapter 2 and some of the points that the author of Judges, wants to make. And so if you'll remember from the first class, we have three sections in the book of Judges. You have the introductory section, which had two parts to it, chapters 1 through 3, 6, I believe it was. Then you have the appendix starting in chapter 17 to the end of the book, which is different than the opening. And then you have all the chapters in between that give the actual layout of the life and times of Israel. But the writer of Judges is not interested, it's not his purpose to give us a strict historical narrative as to what happened next. And there are competing interests in the book of Judges as to what tribe was doing what. There are lots of tribes that aren't mentioned during particular notable episodes, and so some things appear to be skipped. The reason why we have the book of Judges is not so we can fill in the gaps as to what Israel as a whole was doing in terms of, you know, during this 100-year period, the tribe of Dan did this. And during this 100 period, here's what all the tribes are doing. You can't map out the book of Judges in a nice table and say from this year to this year, here's what everybody was doing. It's different than what often appears in the books of Chronicles and Kings, where you get a little more close line as to what the northern tribes are doing, what the southern tribes are doing, what this king was a good king and a bad king. You just don't get that in Judges. It's not written that way. So it's a different style with different purposes in mind. And after studying the layout and some of the lessons in here, I'm convinced that the end of the book of Judges properly belongs to the beginning of the book of Judges. But it was put at the end for a particular point and emphasis that the writer wanted to make. And I think this class is not about what you want, it's about what I want. I want to tackle it chronologically. And so now that we know where everyone stands, we'll proceed. All right. The other point to remember that is often overlooked in the book of Judges is that this was a period. It's reading the book of Judges and being disgusted is like reading the Gospels and being frustrated with the Pharisees. That's low-hanging fruit. That's what we say in the consulting business when someone gives you an easy job. That's low-hanging fruit. You don't have to work hard for that one. It's easy to pick on the Pharisees. Well, it's easy to spot the imperfections of the Judges and of the people. And as I mentioned last week, if your focus when you finish with the book of Judges is on the queerness, the foibles of the characters, which are so pronounced in the book of Judges, you've missed the point. The point is the people refused to listen to the judges, not that the judges were odd characters. We could prove that. We could write a book about, say, the Stillwater Reformed Presbyterian Church and think of all the odd stories we'd get there. And you'd think, oh, wow, these people are really special. And what would that leave us with? Well, it wouldn't leave us with a picture of how we function as a whole. And one of the points you have to remember is that Israel is undergoing a tremendous transition. Up until this time, and when I say Israel, I'm referring to at least the time they were in Egypt as a body. They groaned and they were under the oppression of the Egyptians, and God delivered them. How did he deliver them? Well, through great signs and wonders, didn't he? He had all those miracles that Pharaoh failed to appreciate and take heed to, and he was subsequently destroyed. They had the fire, and they had the cloud to guide them through. They had the mountain when the law was given. They had the voice of Jehovah. They had the shining face of Moses. They had Moses himself. All throughout the time of the wilderness, you can see how they were led by strong, demonstrable evidences. And then comes Joshua. Well, he's hardly a second-class citizen, is he? Strong leader, unites the people, does what God wants him to do. He's got his elders around him, and they execute judgment on the land. And then Joshua and that generation die. Then what are they left with? Well, they were left with God's Word. They weren't left with the body of miracles that they had been historically accustomed to. They weren't left with a strong leader. Joshua didn't name a successor. Why is that? He wasn't supposed to. God didn't tell him to. God told Moses, appoint Joshua, make him a leader of the people. He went out and did that. But they weren't supposed to have a strong central leader. They had been trained, they had God's word, and they had been set out to do what God had told them to do. So things are very different in the life of Israel at this point. And it's a big transition, and they're like teenagers who had been oppressed, and they finally get a little liberty, and it's just like giving money to the government. It goes awry. It just goes awry. And Israel had a complete breakdown. Now, one of the points I'm trying to make in this lesson today is I believe that breakdown occurred quickly, not slowly. I don't believe it was a slow, degenerating disease. I believe it was something that happened overnight, if you will, in terms of the big picture of history. In fact, Matthew Henry makes a comment about the narratives at the end of the book, which I thought was very helpful. He says that they were the two narratives, and there are two stories in these last five chapters here. We're going to look at one today and the next one next week. The two narratives at the end of the book are designed to show what kind of behavior was exhibited during this time. That it might appear how happy the nation was in the judges, it is here shown how unhappy they were when there was none. I think it's a fair point to take. All right, well, I've got 11 points. And the latter half I'm not going to spend near as much time on. I don't think it's as helpful for the points we're trying to cover today, but I do want to cover these. So the second point here, first of all, how does it fit? And then the love of money in these first five verses. So let's read those. Now there was a man from the mountains of Ephraim whose name was Micah, and he said to his mother, "The 1,100 shekels of silver that were taken from you and on which you put a curse, even saying it in my ears, here is the silver with me. I took it." And his mother said, "May you be blessed by the Lord, my son." So when he had returned the 1,100 shekels of silver to his mother said, "I had wholly dedicated the silver from my hand to the Lord for my son, to make a carved image and a molded image. Now therefore I will return it to you." Thus he returned the silver to his mother. Then his mother took 200 shekels of silver and gave them to the silversmith, and he made it into a carved image and a molded image, and they were in the house of Micah. The man Micah had a shrine and made an ephod and household idols, and he consecrated one of his sons who became his priest. So we already have a pretty strange story unfolding before us, and it starts with this confession of Micah for the theft of his mother's money. Now, no mention is made in the account of Micah's father or the husband there, so I'm not sure why he's not. Perhaps she was a widow, and this was her sum to live on. Now, the mother was looking frantically for this money, as you might imagine. It's a fairly large sum of money. And in doing so, she pronounced a curse on the one who stole it. And she did this with within earshot of her son. And again, Henry, if you want a warm, refreshing read Henry's commentary on these two chapters. It really is quite good. He said, "Outward losses drive good people to their prayers, but bad people to their curses." And here she's not praying, she's cursing the thief. And it was his mother's curse and not the threat of violating God's law which brought this grown man trembling before his mommy with money in hand. He was scared of his mother's curse. That meant more to him than transgressing God's law. With one curse, you'll notice that she, with one breath, she curses the thief, her own son, and the next breath, she blesses him. You know, may you be blessed by the Lord, my son. And after making restitution, both of them decide that the best use of this money is to dedicate it to the Lord and build some idols. Now, the text reads a carved image and a molded image, indicating that there was that more than one was made, and one was probably overlaid with gold or silver or something, and the other was actually cast that way. But after the idols, Micah does much more, and he decides that these idols need a place to dwell, so he builds them a shrine. He erects a shrine to these idols. Well, I'm not well versed in how these things work, but I suspect the idols felt insecure because all the other idols had of the land had priests, so why shouldn't they have priests? So Micah then consecrates his son to be his priest. You know, it stays in the family that way, and you probably not have to pay him much. So what do we make of all this? In this first opening account here, what you have is a strange admixture of religion and worship. That's what you've got, is an admixture of religion and worship. Now, I think it would be dangerous to rush to judgment, and it's important to refrain from accusing these people unjustly. They were not worshiping Baal. And that's a distinction I think worth making here. They were worshiping Jehovah. She says, blessed be my son in the Lord's name. And there's no mention in these two chapters of Baal worship as there was at the opening. There's no mention of that happening here. But the problem was the religion they had and the form of worship they had was really something that was done in forms only and in name only. It wasn't heartfelt religion that sprang from a love of God or of His Word. And what they had done here is violated the second commandment. I don't think it's altogether clear that they were violating the first commandment. I believe that happens here, but the point being that in fabricating these idols, having these things commissioned, they are in violation of what God said should occur when they worship Him. Now, I think one of the reasons this distinction is important is that Israel was not going to simply walk away one day from serving Jehovah, not in an outright single step. They didn't wake up one day and say, that's it, we've got nothing else we want to do here. Jehovah would, ostensibly anyway, be their God, but they were free in their own minds to worship Him as they saw fit. And this was wrong for two reasons. First of all, simply on the grounds that God had commanded His people to worship as He had commanded them, and in no other way. And secondly, it opened the door for the worship of other gods, thereby breaking the first commandment. You're not going to be on a trail of breaking the second commandment without also starting the journey for the first commandment as well. One writer observed, and I thought this was rather humorous, that this pretended religion was actually fairly shallow. He remarked that he, that is Micah, resembles a man who, while incestuously marrying his sister, should strictly observe the customary laws of marriage. You know, these guys are nuts. All right. Henry offers another comment on here, and he's quoting a fellow named Lightfoot. Now, I'll give you this just to put in your mind so we can talk about it later. I think Judges has a few of these things that I'll draw together at the end. He says, Lightfoot would have us observe that as the 1,100 pieces of silver were here devoted to the making of an idol, which ruined religion, especially in the tribe of Dan, as we shall presently find, which was Samson's tribe, so 1,100 pieces of silver were given by each Philistine lord for the ruin of Samson. So it's strange how this similar sum of money is placed in the book of Judges. All right, let's move on to number three then, no king, and only in verse six here. In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. When we opened the class, one of the things that was mentioned as part of the characteristic of Judges is this phrase, there was no king in Israel and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And I think that's a phrase that is commonly understood to occur within the book of Judges. It occurs four times in 17:6, 18:1, 19:1, and 21:12. 25. And the phrase, everyone did what was right in his own eyes, only occurs twice. You see the underline 17:6 and 21:25. And I think the reason the writer puts this phrase in here, this no king phrase, has at least maybe two distinct meanings. The first is, he's dating the narrative itself. And I think that's an important point. This book has come under some criticism for elements that appear to have been written much, much later in Israel's history than the time that we anticipated. What he's pointing to there is that, in all likelihood, the book was compiled and written during Saul, or probably David's time. And what he's emphasizing, that in those days, contrasting it with the current days, there's no king in Israel. Now, the second meaning, I think, is a bit more subtle, and I'm convinced that he probably means it these ways as well. It refers to a lack of leadership from among the people, meaning that no central civil government existed in Israel at those times. No government existed which could rebuke the wicked. Therefore, every man did what was right in his own eyes. So the form of government in this tribal confederacy, if you'll think of it that way, was very weak, and they were not policing their own. It's not that the government was altogether missing, but that it was they had lapsed in their duty. It was especially weak, and I think this is another point being made, in the leadership of the Levites. Levitical leadership was non-existent in Israel at this time. It is only these last five chapters of the book that the tribe of Levi is even mentioned. It is placed here, I think, for that purpose. It is an appendix to give us an account of what happened in that tribe. Now, it's dangerous to make speculations as to why something is, to base your opinions on what is missing in Scripture, but I think the point being made here is that we have a history of Israel through the judges. We really don't have a history of what was happening with the Levites. And I think the writer recognizes that and places it here to fill in the picture of why the people had fallen into such decay. I think the second aspect of every man did what was right in his own eyes is a backhanded rebuke to the people for their failure to acknowledge God as their king. The people were not looking because they didn't live like God was their king, and their worship was no better. So I think there are two ways we can see that there is no king in Israel. And in conclusion, we, I think, should remember that there was a serious void of leadership and obedience on both a corporate and a personal level. There's a real leadership crisis in Israel at this time. All right. Verses, the wandering priest. Let's go to verse 7 through verse 13. Now there was a young man from Bethlehem in Judah, of the family of Judah. He was a Levite and was staying there. The man departed from the city of Bethlehem in Judah to stay where he could find a place. Then he came to the mountains of Ephraim, to the house of Micah, as he journeyed. And Micah said to him, "Where do you come from?" He said, "I am a Levite from Bethlehem in Judah, and I am on my way to find a place to stay." Micah said to him, "Dwell with me, and be a father and priest to me, and I will give you 10 shekels of silver per year, a suit of clothes and your sustenance." So the Levite went in. Then the Levite was content to dwell with the man, and the young man became like one of his sons to him. So Micah consecrated the Levite, and the young man became his priest and lived in the house of Micah. Then Micah said, "Now I know that the Lord will be good to me, since I have a Levite as priest." Who was this wandering priest that we find arising in the middle of this? Well, he was a Levite who was, I think, fairly stated, most recently attached to Bethlehem. The text says he was looking for work, but it does make you wonder why he couldn't find any at home, why he had to leave Bethlehem, which is down here, to head up into the mountains of Ephraim. I think you can draw a conclusion from this, which would not be too much of a stretch, to imagine that the local folks were not supporting their priest. This man probably couldn't find anything better. I think it's also possible he just had wandering feet and he liked to move around, a bit of a gypsy. But it's not too far to stretch your imagination to imagine that the work was just not that good down there either. Well, he stumbles on Micah, on his place, and the two of them hit it off. It was a deal that could not be refused on either person's part. For Micah, it was the opportunity to have a legitimate priest serving in his temple or his shrine instead of his son. He had his son there. Well, why not get a real priest when you can? Well, he did. And for the Levite, it was a job providing food, clothes, and pay. Nothing is mentioned in the text with regard to what Micah's son thought of being outsourced by this man from Bethlehem. But that was a problem for them at that time, as it is a problem for us today. So this was an opportunity here, and I think this narrative has some painful details to it. The writer is not writing a general history. They're very specific sums of money. There's a description of the transcript of their conversations going back and forth. A lot of details are being given here. Well, for Micah, this was an opportunity to expand and legitimize his little mini temple that he had erected. This whole story is not here so we can recapture the lost history of some unknown fella. There are lots of people that we don't know about in the book of Israel. Why bring up his story? Because Micah sought to legitimize his little mini-temple. He had a real priest of the Lord to babysit his gods, and it looked to him as the Lord's benevolent providence. I mean, doesn't he say, now I know that the Lord, Yahweh, will be good to me since I have a Levite as priest? You know, he thinks he's serving God. He thinks he's worshiping the Lord. He's building a temple. Henry makes this wry remark. Keep in mind that this Levite had no business becoming a priest. That was a sin on his part. He wasn't of the house of Aaron. No marvel if those who can make anything serve for a god can also make anything serve for a priest. Here he sees this fellow and thinks, this is God's goodness to me. I'm going to be able to really be an important figure in history here. In verse 12, it indicates that Micah consecrates this priest. He actually sets him apart. This is a very solemn duty that he's embarked upon. Micah was very serious and very religious in his duty. This was a dedicated place of worship. And when the installation service was concluded, he confidently assures himself that God is going to prosper his way. There's not a hint of Baal worship contained in this narrative. Paulus Cassell has a very interesting, a very helpful summary of this particular section. I'd like to read it to you. It's a little longer, but I think it's helpful. These words of confidence, that is, Micah, the Lord will bless me, indicate most strikingly the thorough self-deception of the man. He looks for blessings to Jehovah, against whom he has committed the mortal sin of image worship. He expects those blessings on the account of a Levite, who did wrong when he allowed himself to be hired. He who sets up an ephod and teraphim for the enlightenment of others has himself so little insight in it into the spirit of truth as to not perceive that the falsehood of his entire establishment, its downfall, is already assured. Perhaps he also found pleasure in the descent to this Levite, although it ought rather to have frightened him. But self-love blinds him, and his soiled conscience builds hopes on the name of a Levite whose doings in his house challenge the judgments of God. Now know I, he exclaims. He will soon learn how deceptive this knowing is. This is the real problem happening, is that this man is very deceived. He's deceiving many other people. The Levite is only contributing to the problem. A fair question might be, what did the Levite get from all of this? Well, Micah certainly lays on the praise and the affection. He tells him he'll be like a son to me. Come into my house. I'll hire you. You'll be like a son. We'll be buddies. Matthew Poole makes this comment on Micah. He pretends reverence and submission to him, and what is wanting in wages, he pays him in empty titles. He gives him a few shekels a year to live and some clothes and said, you'll be like a son to me. Well, I guess you had to be there to know for sure, but it doesn't strike me as a particularly large sum of money. And Henry, I think he was particularly enamored with this passage. He says, after the listing of the appurtenances, he remarks that the ministry is the best calling, but the worst trade in the world. So, he's good. All right, section 5. In those days, there was no king. We see this phrase repeated again, and we're about to start a new section of the narrative. And a new chapter, and we have some new people that are being introduced. And so in section 6, we have in verse 1, in those days the tribe of the Danites was seeking an inheritance for itself to dwell in. For until that day, their inheritance among the tribes of Israel had not fallen to them. Why didn't the tribe of Dan have an inheritance? Anyone remember? We discussed it in detail. Why didn't they? They didn't even bother to fight. The Amorites drove them from their inheritance. And I think we see this phrase, those days, used again. And I believe what the those days refers to is the time that the Danites had the opportunity to go in and conquer the land, and they failed to. In Judges chapter 1, 34 and 35, we read that the Amorites forced the children of Dan into the mountains, for they would not allow them to come down into the valley. And the Amorites were determined to dwell in Mount Heres in Ajalon and Shaalbim. Yet when the strength of the house of Joseph became greater, they were put under tribute. So this little section right here was the allotment given to the tribe of Dan. And these two cities are Ajalon and Shaalbim. You've got Gezer over here, Ashdod, Joppa, both important cities. Ekron down here to the southwest, Gibeah, Bethel, Shiloh. You can kind of get a picture of where the Danites were at. I believe when we're referring to the mountains, that they were forced up here into Ephraim's territory, but I don't know that for sure. But I think that's where they were supposed to be going. So Dan gave up the fight very early on in his in their particular conquest, and they had no place to call home. They were scattered. Imagine if you were trying to support that whole tribe and you didn't have any place to get the farming done. All the good land was down in the valley, and the Amorites said, nothing doing. You're going back up to the hills. You're not going to live here. So I'm sure they had a lot of difficulty in trying to eke out a living and to have that phrase. But that's the way it was. They refused to fight. Now, Dan's original assignment was given by Joshua, and the details are described in, you can't really see it here, Joshua 19, for anyone taking notes, verses 40 to 48. He says, the seventh lot came out for the tribe of the children of Dan. I think they were the last one, too. According to their families. And the territory of their inheritance was Zorah, Eshtal, Shemesh, Shaalbim, Ajalon, Jethro, Elon, and it goes on, and the region near Joppa. And the border of the children of Dan went beyond these, because the children of Dan went up to fight against Leshem, and took it, and they struck it with the edge of the sword, took possession of it, and dwelt in it. They called Leshem Dan after the name of Dan their father. This is the inheritance of the tribe of the children of Dan, according to their families, these cities with their villages. And the town Leshem is also called Laish. And this is where they're at, right up here. So when we're speaking of Dan, the town, you're referring to the northernmost part of Israel, not here Dan, where their original allotment was given. So they had a fair distance to try to cover in order to try to get their inheritance. Okay. I'll make one point here that we'll discuss with a little more detail. We don't really know exactly in the mountains of Ephraim where Micah was located, but my suspicion is we have here Shiloh, which was the place for worship, and that's where the children were to gather together for their corporate worship, and they had not been doing so. This was also a neglected point we'll see at the end of this narrative. So I suspect Micah's dwelling somewhere over in here and setting up his mini shrine, his little mini temple there, in opposition to Shiloh. But it does give you a sense of the lay of the land as to where these cities were located. So let's look at chapter 18, verses 2-6. So the children of Dan sent 5 men of their family from the territory, men of valor from Zorah and Eshtol, to spy out the land and search for it. They said to them, go search the land. So they went up to the mountains of Ephraim, to the house of Micah, and lodged there. While they were at the house of Micah, they recognized the voice of the young Levite. They turned aside and said to him, who brought you here? What are you doing in this place? What do you have here? He said to him, thus and so Micah did for me. He has hired me, and I have become his priest. So they said to him, please inquire of God that we may know whether the journey on which we will go will be prosperous. And the priest said to him, go in peace. The presence of the Lord be with you on your way. Now, Dan had sent five spies up here to see if they could find some land that they could conquer in their eyes. They were afraid of the Amorites, and they didn't think they could take their possession. So they send these five guys up here and say, you head up to Dan. So they're probably in this area right about here. They've got to go through the mountains of Ephraim, eventually all the way up to where the Laish is. That's their journey. And they were sent there to see if they could find any place where they could live, a land where they could conquer and it wouldn't be so difficult. I cannot help but wonder when you read this and you see that they're leaving their inherited place to find something so far away. It's not like they were conquering a small part of what Ephraim had or what Benjamin had. I can't help but wondering if they're in fact trying to escape the discipline of the Lord. They just don't want to do what God has for them. And they've decided that, hey, it's better to just pack up and go somewhere else that we can make for our own. I don't think it was necessarily wrong, per se, for them to acquire the additional land. Certainly, if they had grown and prospered and needed it, you could get the impression that there was a good reason for it. But they hadn't driven out the inhabitants of the first parcel they were given. So it's sort of like the guy who's decided that he's going to work on his second million because getting the first million has just been entirely too difficult. You know, they're going after something they can't have. And they decide in their own minds, we'll just go somewhere else. They send these guys up here to spy out the land. Somehow, they run across Micah's house and priest. Now, this is not random. They weren't. It wasn't a coincidence. They were obviously God directing all of their steps. And what's interesting is they go through this area, and how would they find this one little fellow's house and this one little itty-bitty shrine if it was completely insignificant? I think what you're finding is that they stayed there, they lodged there, because they had heard about the place, and they wanted to see what was going on. The men recognize the priest's voice, which is an odd thing, but it's not exactly detailed how they did that. And what these men are doing is going to Micah's house to inquire of the Lord once they find out he's there. But it doesn't seem to have entered into their mind that they should go to Shiloh and find out from the Lord whether their journey will be prosperous or not. They could have done that and been well within their rights. Now, they do ask to inquire of the Lord. They're not interested, will Baal tell us what to do? But they're asking the wrong person in the wrong place with the wrong means. In Judges 12, there is the account of the Ephraimites and the Gileadites who had used local dialects to determine if you were a friend or foe. You remember the shibboleth portion of it. Perhaps there was something like this used to identify that this man was living in Ephraim, but he had a different way of speaking, a different dialect or something to identify him as someone who was not from around here. The Levite, you got to give this guy credit. He was sharp. I mean, he knew what he was doing. He gave them, what did he tell them? Go in peace and the Lord will watch over your steps. I forget the exact wording. Something to that effect. He gave them a technically correct and perfectly useless answer. There was nothing of value. There was nothing that you could have told those things that it wouldn't made you a priest or a prophet or indicate that the Lord had spoken to you. Go in peace. The presence of the Lord be with you on your way. Well, where else was the presence of the Lord going to be but on them and on their way? Where could they possibly go where they wouldn't be in God's presence? So this guy is just playing priest, and he knows it. And he gives these fellows empty words to add legitimacy to his office to keep up the charade. All right. Let's look at verses 7 through 13. So the five men departed and went to Laish. They saw the people who were there, how they dwelt safely in the matter of the Sidonians, quiet and secure. There were no rulers in the land who might put them to shame for anything. They were far from the Sidonians, and they had no ties with anyone. Then the spies came back to their brethren at Zorah and Eshtaol, and their brethren said to them, "What is your report?" They said, "Arise, let us go up against them. For we have seen the land, and indeed it is very good. Would you do nothing? Do not hesitate to go and enter to possess the land. When you go, you will come to a secure people and a large land. For God has given it into your lands, a place where there is no lack of anything that is on earth." And 600 men of the family of the Danites went from there, from Zorah and Eshtaol, armed with weapons of war. Then they went up and camped at Kirjath-Jearim in Judah. Therefore they call that place Mahoneh Dan to this day. Therefore it is west of Kirjath-Jearim. And they passed from there to the mountains of Ephraim. And it came to the house of Micah. Now, I'm not sure how they landed at this spot. It's not on the way. I don't know if they were... They obviously didn't want to settle. I say obviously. I'm assuming they didn't want to settle in another tribe's territory. And I believe Asher and... I think Naphtali had the northernmost regions, if I'm not mistaken. So they had to go pretty far. And that's a fair amount of distance to cover and to try to find some place where you can support the tribe. And they found this Sidonian colony. So here was Sidon, which was really the capital of the Phoenicians there. And they had Tyre, which later on in Alexander's day was more important. But here they're way up here. And the place ultimately becomes known as Dan when they rename it. And I don't know why the Sidonians felt so comfortable and at ease. It goes through great pains to indicate that these people were not guarded. They had no defenses. They were secure. There were no rulers in the land who might put them to shame for anything. There's another reference to a people who were living without any strong central government. Perhaps they just thought everything would be okay. They were a Sidonian colony, far away, no real danger. The Israelites are going to come this far north. What do we need to pay for all that for? Why don't we just let these guys go? I'm not sure the reason, but they were obviously dwelling in safety. Now, what I don't understand, and I find a bit confusing, is that the history of the tribe of Dan is very cloudy after the book of Judges. You don't hear much of the Danites as a rule. Now, the narrative tells us that 600 men, which is not a lot of men, 600 men went up to fight this, and I don't know if by that they were sending a battalion, a group, one army unit up there to fight, or whether these were the only people that could go. I'm not sure. I don't understand. There is, during the census of Israel in Numbers 26, there were 64,000 Danites listed. Now, a fair amount of time has taken, has transpired, so I'm not sure how many there are at this time. But to go from 64,000 to only being able to send 600 strikes me as a pretty small portion. So it could be that the whole tribe did not decide to go up. They weren't all in favor of this, or that there was only really one group who got tired of living in the mountains and wanted someplace else and decided to go on their own. But either way, the Danites are just not well known after this point. In Revelation 7, where the account is given that so many from this tribe and the tribes are listed, Dan's not even listed as one of the tribes. Joseph is listed, not his two sons, and the Levi is listed, but Dan is not. So I don't understand or appreciate the meaning of what happens to the Danites as they fall into obscurity, but it appears that they do. All right, the loss of gods, section 9, verses 14 through 26. Then the five men who had gone to spy out the country of Laish answered and said to their brethren, "Do you know that there are in these houses an ephod, household idols, a carved image, and a molded image? Now therefore consider what you should do." So they turned aside there and came to the house of a young Levite man, to the house of Micah, and greeted him. The 600 armed men with their weapons of war, who were of the children of Dan, stood by the entrance of the gate. Then the five men who had gone to spy out the land went up. Entering there, they took the carved image, the ephod, the household idols, and the molded image. The priest stood at the entrance of the gate with the 600 men who were armed with weapons of war. When these went into Micah's house and took the carved image, the ephod, the household idols, and the molded image, the priest said to him, "What are you doing?" And they said to him, "Be quiet. Put your hand over your mouth and come with us. Be a father and a priest to us." Is it better for you to be a priest to the household of one man, or that you be a priest to a tribe and family in Israel? So the priest's heart was glad, and he took the ephod and the household idols and the carved image, and took his place among the people. Then they turned and departed, and put little ones, the livestock, and the goods in front of them. When they were a good way from the house of Micah, the men who were in the houses near Micah's house gathered together and overtook the children of Dan. And they called out to the children of Dan. So they turned around and said to Micah, "What ails you that you have gathered such a company?" And he said, "You've taken away my gods, which I made, and the priest, and you have gone away. Now what more do I have? How can you say to me, 'What ails you?'" And the children of Dan said to him, "Do not let your voice be heard among us, lest angry men fall upon you and you lose your life with the lives of your household." Then the children of Dan went their way. And when Micah saw that they were too strong for him, he turned and went back to his house. This section just drips with irony. There's a lot in that section. The whole narrative opened with Micah's confession of having stolen money from his mother, and now men come and steal the idols from him. You know, he didn't escape God's judgment. The priest whom he had hired and had given his shrine a greater degree of legitimacy now abandons him so that he might have greater legitimacy. The Danites entice him. They want to make him a legitimate priest. Said, "Wouldn't it be better if you were in charge of a whole tribe rather than just one household?" Yeah, sounds like a good idea. And so he did. Micah had hired the man using praises and titles. "You'll be a son, I'll be your father." And now the Danites do the very thing to Micah when to the priest when they say, "Is it better for you to be a priest of a household or a man, to a priest as a tribe or and a family in Israel?" And here they're exaggerating. You know, they tell him, "Do you want to be a priest of the whole family of Israel? One whole tribe." This wasn't one whole tribe. It was 600 people. There were 60-some thousand of them left back home. So here they're dripping with flattery and praise, trying to entice this man to come to work for him, which is exactly what Micah had done to him. The gods which were fashioned and had given him the prosperity he enjoyed in the eyes of his brethren are shown to be absolutely powerless in stopping petty thieves. A couple of thugs, a gang shows up, and all of his gods get taken, and his priest to boot. They weren't of much use, it doesn't appear. Perhaps the most telling verse in the whole story is verse 24. So he said, "You have taken away my gods, which I made, and a priest, and you have gone away. Now, what more do I have?" When he says, "What more do I have?" indicates that he realized he had nothing left. Well, if he had put his hope in Jehovah and had worshipped him for all these years, he would still have Jehovah. They can't take that from him. Micah put all of his trust in those gods, and they were taken from him. That's why he was crying out. I don't think it was the loss of money, although I'm sure it was significant. But Micah also had the people from around his area come out to get these Danites and say, "Why are you doing all this?" So obviously he enjoyed some stature among the people that he could gather together a small little garden militia to try to tackle these guys. He says, "You've taken everything from me." But since all he ever had were images, all of it was taken away. You know, when you think about Micah and all that's happened to him, it's a real story of pity, isn't it? To see this man who starts off as a petty thief, robbing his own mother and trying to support his family or do whatever he was going to do. I don't know if he's a fast thinker and he talks his mom into dedicating this by putting money into idols, or whether that was his intent. We don't know. Maybe he was just a fast thinker. Sound like a good idea. And it grew, and it grew. And he wanted the prestige. He wanted the legitimacy. He sought out these people. He took the opportunities as they came. And he made for himself a grand little mini temple, his shrine. Now everything is taken from him. And it shows us the complete bankruptcy of Israel's worship at this time. That they didn't have a priest to rebuke him, to tell him, "Look, you're violating the second commandment in doing this." Where were the priests? They were complicit. were the actions and the sins. They weren't there rebuking them. So let's look at verses 27 to 29. So they took the things Micah had made, and the priesthood belonged to him. And they went to Laish, to a people quiet and secure, and they struck them with the edge of the sword and burned the city with fire. There was no deliverer, because it was far from Sidon, and they had no ties with anyone. It was in the valley that belongs to Beth-Rehob. So they rebuilt the city and dwelt there. And they called the name of the city Dan, after the name of Dan their father, who was born into Israel. However, the name of the city formerly was Laish. Now Dan occupies the northernmost territory of Israel. And I don't know if this phrase is familiar to you, but if you heard the phrase from Dan to Beersheba, that's what they're describing there is all of Israel, Dan all the way down to Beersheba, taking into account the whole lay of the land. And that's why it got started, because the Danites went up north and were able to take over. All right, well, let's bring this to a close. In section 10, verses 30 and 31, then the children of Dan set up for themselves the carved image, and Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Manasseh, and his sons were priests to the tribe of Dan until the day of the captivity of the land. So they set up for themselves Micah's carved image, which he had made, all the time that the house of God was in Shiloh. Well, there are three points that I want to make with these last two verses. The first is that Micah's idols had a great influence of Israel and had led many astray. First, it was his private sins in his own house. Then he involved the priest. He involved his neighbors and his community in that area, the mountains of Ephraim. Then it went to the Danites, to the five men who had come up, then to the 600, and now the whole city. Micah's idols were very destructive in the history of Israel. Secondly, I'm not going to press this point too forcefully, but I think it goes well with what the author's trying to make, the point he's trying to make. Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Manasseh. Apparently, there is very little difference in the spelling of Manasseh and Moses. And that some of the Jews could not bring themselves to put the letter on the same level of height as they did when they wrote Moses' name, and so they would drop this letter a little bit in the text. Now, there seemed to be a fair amount of agreement among the commentators for this. And I don't know if, in fact, that's exactly what happened, and maybe it's a point we really can't determine. But in Exodus 2:22, we find that Moses did have a son named Gershom. And it says, and she, Zipporah, that is, bore him a son. He called his name Gershom, for he said, I have been a stranger in a foreign land. Now, whether this was actually the grandson or a great-grandson, sometimes they leave out a generation or two when they're identifying a particular genealogy. But why at this point identify the priest? What's the point? The author's concluding the story, and he's got several things that he wants to bring out and press. One of the points early in the book was that Israel served the Lord in the days of Joshua and all the elders who lived during the days of Joshua. Then they fell away. Well, parental ancestry does not buy you into the kingdom of God. If this, in fact, was Moses' grandson or great-grandson, it didn't do him any good. He should have known better. He should have known what was expected of him. He was raised better than this. And he was leading Israel astray. Another tension, the third point, throughout this whole book comes through, especially in this story, and it's decline of corporate and tribal worship. In this account, at the end here, a specific mention of Shiloh is made. Now why? Why at the end start talking about Shiloh? Well, here is where the house of God was established, and yet there seems in this one narrative to be two contenders for the central place of worship. It was Micah's house and Dan's shrine. It is a point that I think the author wants to make, that they had the opportunity to do better, and they set up an alternate form of worship, which is exactly what God had warned them against. Do not worship me in means that I have not commanded you. So the whole point of Judges 17 and 18 is to remind us of the dangers of idolatry, of worshiping Jehovah in an empty or wrongful fashion. it also shows us the swift decline people can fall into. The Danites, I think, are this section is fits well with the opening of the time period of the Judges. And if you recall in Judges 2:17, that it says that the people quickly turned from the way in which their fathers walked in obeying the commandments of the Lord, and they did not do so. It was characteristic of the people to not always be faithful. So it's not hard to imagine Joshua and the elders dying and the people falling into the state of disarray which we find in chapter 17 and 18. It's serious stuff to create this admixture of worship in the house of the Lord. Very jealous for it. So, well, I ran over, so if you have any comments or questions, save them for next week, and we'll cover the remaining chapters of the book then.